Hey, folks, this is Rabble Rouser. All right, folks, this is Rabble Rouser.
Yo, it's the Tornado, Tony Pennycal. I'm laughing at you, Rich.
And sorry we're late there. I introduced myself twice. I'm so discombobulated.
Yeah, because the Blog Talk Radio lady cut you the hell off.
Yeah. It's her show. That's why. It's not really my show. Anyway, we got Lisa Belkov-Snyder on tonight on the Combat Sports Show. Tom will probably be connected in any minute. We got a ton of UFC stuff to talk about. We got quite a bit of stories to cover on boxing, namely the big guy, Bernard Hopkins, won again. Won a title.
And who predicted it?
You did.
Yes, I did. I get a free breakfast out of that shit, too. Nice. I actually got really, really sick starting Friday night. And I don't know if anybody's seen my Facebook statuses. I actually went to a healthcare professional, which means that I was pretty much sick. We were out Friday night, we were having a good time, and I started getting real lightheaded, and I started getting real dizzy. My one friend, she put her hand on my neck, she goes, "Jesus Christ, you're burning up." So we went back to my one friend's house. I was crashing there anyway, and within 2 minutes, I was out. And then I went home the next day, and I slept. You know, I slept for 8 hours at my friend's house, went home, and went right back to sleep for almost another 6 hours. And I was having friends over for the fight that night, absolutely. And I'm like, and everybody's like, "No, you should cancel it." And I'm like, "No, I can't cancel this. My friends are coming over. I want to hang out with my friends, and I want to watch this fight." Because I knew, as bad as I felt, that if I was watching the fight by myself, I wouldn't have made it through the fight, just because I was that weak and I was that, you know, tired and falling asleep that much. But, you know, my friends came over. We had some pizzas. I was having a hard time eating. You know, I could barely chew them. And then the fights, and everybody was looking at me. And I'm like, "Dude, the guy's a freaking master." But right now, at his advanced age, at 48, the fact that he's beating world-class fighters at 48 years old is an anomaly. You know, it's a testament to how great the guy really is. But there's certain type of fighters he has to fight now. Tavares Cloud was the perfect opponent. Tavares Cloud is a very good fighter. He's a hard puncher, but he's also a very straight-in type fighter that doesn't deal well with a lot of lateral movement. Now, Bernard looked so good against Cloud. On the flip side, he looked so bad against Dawson, who predicates his offense on a lot of movement. So that fight was very unexciting, and Dawson was just able to do enough to, you know, pick up enough points to win the fight. Cloud, being more aggressive, played Hopkins' game. Hopkins right now, the types of guys he would want to fight, Nathan Cleverley would be a good opponent for him. Even a very good fighter like Carl Froch would be a good opponent, because Froch is very straightforward, very aggressive. That would be a good fight for him.
You heard. He's already decided who he's going to fight next.
It's not a mandatory contender that nobody's heard of, is it?
It is.
What's the guy's name? Kawa Moret or something like that?
Charo Moret, yeah.
Yeah. I can't tell you if that guy's a good opponent or not, because I can't say if I've ever even heard of the guy. And so I think it was KO Digest on Facebook the other day. Mentioned it. And the first thing I said was, I remember a fight about 10 years ago going to the Spectrum when he fought a mandatory contender by the name of Marat, and it was one of the worst fights I've ever seen. And it wasn't Hopkins' fault, but it was a bad fight. Hakkar got in the ring and literally started running in circles. Yeah, I think he threw 5 punches in the first round, any of them. And Bernard hit him around with a right hand and buckled his knee. And Bernard pulled back and was like, "Oh, shit, I can end this fight right now." But he goes, "I want to give these people a show." He was sort of like rolling his shoulders and making faces at him. And he carried the guy for 8 rounds before he knocked him out. So, I can't tell you if this guy would be a good opponent. I would say a guy like Carl Froch could be a good opponent, because Froch is a very aggressive fighter. Arthur Abraham would be a good opponent. Abraham's boxing more now, but the original Arthur Abraham, that was more of a slugger, would be a good fit for Hopkins. A terrible fit, and I think this is the reason Hopkins went over to Andre Ward right after the fight and said, "I respect you, choose no amount of money could make us fight," was because Bernard knows that would be the absolute worst kind of opponent that he could draw. Andre Ward right now is such a smart, intelligent fighter. I don't think he would let Bernard get into his head. And Andre is not a straightforward, aggressive fighter. He's a lot of lateral movement, a lot of boxing ability. I think it would be a very unentertaining fight, and I think Andre Ward would win that by a very comfortable unanimous decision. That would be, if I was with Hopkins at all, I would get as far away from Andre Ward as I could.
All right. Well, we have Psychic Tom just tapped in.
Outstanding analysis, Tony. I have to totally agree with you on that. You broke that down perfect. That's why you get paid the big bucks. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if you were on when I was talking about the fight the other night. I happened to get really sick. I was telling Rich the day before or the night before, and I was still sick and I'm having some of my friends over. And everybody was like, "No, you shouldn't have people over. You're not even able to drive." And I'm like, I don't care. I literally, in a span of the 24 hours leading up to that fight, I think I slept 16 of them. And I'm like, I'm still on antibiotics now and all that shit. But I'm going to the fights tomorrow night. And, you know, hoping for the best.
You and I are at the same club right now. I'm in the ranks of the walking wounded myself because I just pretty much ruined my back the other day. I don't even know how I did it. According to the symptoms online, it sounds like I had a disc, which could take a few days or a few weeks. They don't know. But, ironically, you're only supposed to have one day of rest and you're supposed to stay active with it, which is a pain in the ass. Literally, way down in the lower back too. So it's just anywhere you bend over, you get that shooting pain.
Rich, how familiar are you with reflexology? You studied that?
Not really. Not really very much.
Yeah. Well, if you go to the arch in about the middle of your foot, on the inner part, start rubbing around in there, and if you find something that really is extra sensitive, you want to scream, that's good. Keep working it. That might help.
I'd be a chiropractor at this point. Anyway, I'm hanging tough for the show here. And tonight we actually have Lisa Schneider, who is a national sports commentator and radio show host herself. She's going to talk about women's MMA. Women's impacts, the women's MMA game's impact on other professional sports as well. And she's going to answer a few questions for us about Rousey and Carmouche there and their big fight and what it means for the sport and how women have leveled out the playing field in mixed martial arts and just basically what kind of impact this story has had in women's MMA. So perfect guest for us. We're going to have for a few minutes to talk about that. We have a big UFC 158 card coming up. Of course, Nick Diaz is back in the news for being a no-show at the pre-fight workouts. Supposedly something happened if he didn't show up to the press conference today, but I haven't seen anything about whether he did or not. I'm sure he did because I would have heard if he did. But from what I've read so far, I would say Nick Diaz is going to be thrown out of the UFC immediately after his loss if he does not beat Jordan St. Pierre. So you can imagine there's probably a lot more pressure on him now that he's been screwing up so bad here, not showing up to media day and all kinds of stuff and missing press conferences before. Had to have his fight changed at one point. So it's been a very rocky relationship. And basically, Dana White has come out and said that unless he wins, talk. find somebody he really hated this much. He probably hates Nick Diaz. You know, Dana White has said this so much about him, you know, if he wins, that it seems like it's almost inevitable he's getting thrown out immediately after a loss. And I would hope that the Vegas would not put lines on that, because I would win a fortune.
Well, yeah, and I think it'll be interesting if it stays on the feed. I didn't know that Nick Diaz was sparring with Andre Ward. As we were just, ironically, as Tony was just talking about Andre Ward and what a technician he is. And
well, George St. Pierre trained with Freddie Roach.
Have you caught the countdown yet? Yeah, have you caught the countdown yet? Well, you remember how Diaz was making a big deal out of the fact that he says when GSP's in there with Roach, he's just hitting the punch mitts. And he says, when I'm in there with Andre Ward, we're sparring. Well, we'll find out. We'll find out in two nights.
Yes, we will. And this is one anticipated fight, to be sure. Now, there's been a lot of controversy on whether Diaz deserves this chance. But I don't know. I mean, he's just a popular fighter with the fans. I mean, I don't know why they like him so much. He seems to be very disrespectful whenever I see him in the public eye. But he claims he has anxiety, so maybe that's part of it. Maybe his brain is just that screwed up from as many fights as he's had. He's had actually more than George said.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that he strikes a chord in people of being just, you know, what you see is what you get, like an old-school throwback. Because I will say in his defense that, you know, he is one of those guys, anyone, anytime, anywhere. And when he wins, he doesn't really gloat as much as you'd think he would. And then when he loses, he doesn't seem to complain too much. He's complaining about the Condit decision. But and a lot of people seem to resonate with that. So, I don't know. It's kind of hard to figure. But he does have his fans, for sure.
I think he's kind of like an Arturo Gatti of MMA, because he does put himself at risk to take advantage of an opponent and get an opponent to come closer and then tag him. But it doesn't always work out for him.
Yeah.
To do that. But he's exciting whenever he can be. And so I think that's what the UFC liked about him. That's why they brought him in. And, you know, this good versus evil fight here is a perfect thing to sell tickets. So I think it'll be a big fight. Hopefully Nick Diaz steps up to the plate and takes real good advantage of the situation that he's in and fights to keep his job. And then we'll get to watch train wreck go for him and Dana White. But chances are, if he loses, like I said, he's out. He's gone. No questions asked. And he'll find a quick home, maybe with Bellator or one of the other leagues. The co-main event on this one's pretty interesting, too, because I think Rory McDonald got hurt. Now, Carl Condit is facing Johnny Hendricks in the co-main event. Condit is 28-6, and Hendricks is 14-1. And Condit's trying to get a title shot again himself, I'm sure. So this is going to be interesting. Jake Ellenberger is coming in to fight Nate Marquardt from Strikeforce, switched over from Strikeforce there. Same as Nick Diaz, actually, but he came a little earlier. Ellenberger is a tough guy when he's on. He's just unstoppable. He's 28-6. Marquardt is 32-11-2. Both of those are really good fights. Forward to watching those as well in the main event. We also have some Ultimate Fighter veterans, Chris Camozzi and Nick Ring. Camozzi is 18-5, and Nick Ring is 13-1. Ring doesn't fight all that much, but he's been around for a long time in the UFC and doesn't really get main event, main card status, I should say, that often. So that's a big fight for him. Camozzi's been around in front of the big crowds before, so he's got a little bit more experience, I think. But Nick Ring is pretty damn good. We also have another recent tough vet, Mike Ritchie, who's 7-3, fighting Colin Fletcher, who's 8-2. And Cote is back. Patrick is 18-8. He's fighting Bobby Volker, who's 24-8. And we've got Darren Elkins, 15-2, fighting Antonio Carvalho. Jordan Main, 26-8, fighting Dan Miller, 14-6. Darren Cruikshank, 12-2, fighting John McDessie, who's 10-2. That seems like a pretty easy match fight there. I got Rick Story, 14-6, fighting Quinn Mulhern, 18-2. TJ Dillashaw, 6-1, fighting Izzy Tamora, 7-3. Finally, we got Ruben Duran. I'm not sure if he's related to Roberto, but I doubt it. He's 8-4-1 versus George Roop, who's 12-9-1. I think Dick Diaz might not be the only one to get thrown out if he loses on this card. They're looking to get rid of so many people lately. It's hard to believe. But,
the pressure is on, for sure.
According to Matt Riddle, it's because they want to get rid of some people to bring in younger talent. They don't have to pay as much. Which we were asking the question, why is he making all these cuts? He doesn't have a fighter cap for a number of fighters. There isn't a salary cap or anything in place because there's no kind of national MMA regulation committee or anything. It's just the athletic unions, the boxing commissions that oversee it. So I don't know what it is, but that kind of makes sense, even though it's coming from a guy who just got thrown out himself. But anyway, another funny story here, sort of interesting. We talked about how Real Steel translated to the TV show recently with the Fighting Robot, Robot Combat League, as it gets called. Well, now... The movies have come to life here in a Maximum Fighting Championship event where heavyweights who are brothers will be in the main event.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. I'm sure Mom will be real happy about that one, huh?
Yeah. I don't know if this has ever been done before. They say it hasn't. This is the first time, but I find it to be pretty hard.
Well, it's probably never been done in a cage. But it's probably done every night in living rooms and backyards, but yeah.
That's true.
Well, have you seen the picture of these guys?
I don't know if it's on this article.
Yeah, well, I caught the picture of them. They didn't look like they were in that good a shape. Well, of course, you can't judge a book by its cover. We'll find out, but...
Well, it's Treadwell.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting.
Well, hopefully we can get them on the show sometime. You know, it'd be interesting to talk to them.
Yeah, that'd be fun. What to see. But it's kind of funny what they talked about in the article. Thomas Treadwell is a 20-year-old specialty mechanic, and he said this is something we're excited about, and I think people are going to be very excited to see. Mike Treadwell is 30 years old, 10 years old. He says, we're taking brotherhood to the next level. And he served in the Canadian Armed Forces and has a background in security. So, a lot of experience with combat, I guess, or hand-to-hand techniques. And Mike Treadwell said, it doesn't matter the names of the competitors, brothers are fighting, that's all that we'll take. We're excited. And, the level of interest from friends and colleagues has overshadowed the small wave of negative feedback the brothers have received from certain family members, though another brother, Russ, will corner Thomas. Dad was angry and thinks we're idiots. Mom knows, but we don't talk about it with her. Everyone else seems supportive, said Thomas. And the promoter of the MFC said, the moment I mentioned to just a handful of people that this fight was going to take place, their reaction was pure fascination, and then instantly it turned to a state of unbridled enthusiasm to see it for themselves. So apparently the gimmick is working wonders.
Now, when is this happening, Rich? Have you got the date on it?
Ah, geez, I just shut the window. Probably should have mentioned it.
Okay.
Hang on. Yeah, it's MFC 30s to search it online. Anybody who's listening, but we'll get it in a second if I can find it. Oh, no, a long time ago. There it is. It's called The Real Life Warrior. That was the movie, The Warrior, where the two brothers fight in the finale. But in that one, they got up to the fight, almost all the way up to the fight, and you don't know they're brothers. All the way into the tournament, you've known these guys are brothers for a while. So, that's kind of a good hype to sell it on. All right, where's the date? May 10th, Friday, May 10th. So you have months in advance to plan to be at this event at the Shaw Conference Center in Edmonton, Alberta.
Okay.
So book your plane tickets now. Here's another interesting boxing story we could talk about real quick before these tap. Concussions. Somehow. You guys got any thoughts on that one?
Well, I couldn't. You cut out on me a little bit. Can you repeat it?
Yeah.
The International Boxing Association oversees amateur boxing, and they have mandated that headgear will be banned in amateur competition in an effort to reduce concussions and head trauma. Ought to be affordable. I know I've heard the story of, well, you know, you want to reduce concussions in the NFL, take away their helmets.
Well,
I don't know how to fight.
And you know what the funny thing is? I've said this pretty much since my amateur days. You know, and at Lock Haven, you know, we would have a hard work in. But Dr. Cox also used to like to sit us down and just talk to us. And so it wasn't, you like to train your mind as much as you like to, you know, train you physically. And, you know, we would always talk about just different things. And the one thing he always said, and I agree with this, something he said I didn't agree with, but I agree with this one. Headgear, the most important thing is to prevent cuts, you know, on your cheekbone and your eyelids. And it gives you just enough when you have with the cheek protectors and on your forehead, that, you know, obviously, I mean, you can get a broken nose because I've gotten mine broken a couple times, but it also gives a little bit of cushioning where your nose doesn't protrude as much. It gives just a little bit of padding on there to help protect your nose. But the most important thing it does is it protects your eyebrows, and it protects you from getting cut over the eyes, which you see. Go back to the Hopkins fight last week, which was incorrectly ruled a headbutt. It was a clean punch. It caught him right on the eyebrow. That headgear, which goes over your forehead and usually covers your eyebrows, most of the time, 99% of the time, prevents a lot of cuts in that region. It does not prevent concussions. Concussions come from your brain slamming in against inside of your skull. And a lot of times, if a fighter gets his head rocked back pretty, you know, he takes a good one on the chin, his head rocks back, you figure you have basically 6 more ounces on your head. There's another almost half a pound rocking back and snapping back on your head. That's 6 more ounces of weight that is carrying that brain into your skull. So, no, headgear's don't help prevent concussions. Their main point of importance is preventing cuts. Because you have a lot of, imagine the Olympics, where a guy might have to compete 4 or 5 times. He gets cut in that first fight over his eye, he's done. You have these, you know, college boxing tournaments. You have actually the regionals for college boxing starts tomorrow. I was talking to the Lock Haven University coach, Ken Cooper. But you figure, you get one of these fighters, you know, he's the favorite to go on there and maybe win the national title. He goes on there, these guys, there's a headbutt in the first round. And believe me, I've butted heads many times in college boxing or training in the gym, and I was lucky enough to walk out of there unscathed. But tonight, or tomorrow night, semifinals in the regionals, and I'm in a weight class that I'm predicted to win, and I'm actually the favorite to go to the nationals and win. And I clash heads. Well, I take a lucky punch that cuts me. Well, now, not only am I out for the regionals, the general favorite is now out for the nationals. It's not like a world title fight where you can just postpone it a few months.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It doesn't seem to make sense when you first hear it, but put it in those terms, I guess it does make some sense. It's one of those little things that they're trying to do to make it more like our regular boxing, get the fans involved, and we'll see what happens. I mean, you know, if it doesn't work out, they can always bring headgear back, but. I guess it definitely prepares you a little bit better for the pro ranks when you're fighting.
Well, yeah. If you go back and look at some of the great Olympics of the past, the '76 Olympic team, which is probably heralded as the greatest U.S. Olympic team, Sugar Ray Leonard, the Sphinx brothers, they did not, wear headgear. You know, I remember watching some of those old Sugar Ray Leonard fights. Not wearing headgear. I remember watching Frazier in 64, Foreman in 68, Ali in 60. You know, a lot of these great, you know, U.S. Olympic gold medalists, and they were not wearing headgear. I mean, I just understood, you know, from learning from Dr. Cox that, you know, it was the main focus was keeping but preventing concussions, no, it wouldn't. You know, obviously it could help lessen concussions because you figure, I mean, there's, you know, I'm going to come out and you guys might disagree with me. In boxing, it's always going to be hard, you know, to really prevent as much trauma because a lot of the trauma goes unseen. And I'll tell you, there are times I sparred sometimes 4, 5, 6 days in a row while I was getting ready for big fights. Some days would only be 2 rounds. Some days would be 7, 8, or 9 rounds. And, you know, obviously we're not going out there with the killer instinct on trying to, you know, knock your opponent out. You're trying to go out there and you're trying to learn, but still, you're getting hit. I remember very first sparring session. And Dr. Cox wanted to teach me a lesson. I was kind of blash, kind of cocky. He put me in there with this kid who I actually was just talking on Facebook a week ago, Dirk Weaver. And Dirk was a returning All-American, and Doc, you know, gave Dirk some instruction saying, you know what, teach this kid a lesson. And Dirk bumped me on my ass. You know, he gave me pin, cracked me with a couple good shots and knocked me on my ass. And I'm sitting there now with, like, my pride kind of hurt. And I was getting ready to go home for, weekend vacation. And I didn't want to go home and people say, hey, how's training going? How's boxing going? And I don't want to say, well, we just sparred for the first time and I got knocked on my ass. You know, my side didn't want to do that. And I was begging Dr. Cox, like, that happened on a Wednesday. And I'm going home on Friday. And I'm begging him to let me spar on Thursday. And I was like, you know, okay, obviously it's not going to be against Dirk, you know. Rookie like me, you know, let us just go 3 rounds, even if we get a real light. And Doc says, no. He goes, kid, you just got trapped on your ass yesterday. He goes, the last thing I want to do is put you in there again. You might take another shot. And next thing you know, it's like you could be done. You know, it could rattle your confidence before you could be on, you could be beyond repair. And I said, no, please, I don't want to go home saying I got knocked on my ass. And he goes, well, you can't take back yesterday. No matter what you do today, you should have knocked on your ass yesterday. And you didn't have to go home until you got knocked on your ass. And that was his goal. That was his idea, you know. But you have a lot of these guys in sparring. Go back to the Mike Tyson Buster Douglas fight 23 years ago. And the big thing was Tyson got dropped in sparring by Greg Page. And the only reason anybody knows about it was because it was Mike Tyson and was getting ready for a title fight that he eventually lost. That's a huge underdog. But how many times do you have guys that get hurt in sparring sessions or, you know, get rattled pretty good or get dropped and get up and keep sparring and then you can spar the next day and then fight a week or two later? That's where your head trauma comes in.
All right.
Very, very good point. Yeah.
Well, we got time now. We're going to, I guess, call out to Lisa Belkov-Snyder. I'm thinking she was going to call in. Call out. Going to talk to us about women in MMA.
This is Lisa.
Hello, Lisa. This is Rabble Rouse and Rich Bergeron from Fight News Unlimited Combat Sports Show. How's it going?
Hey, it's going great. How are you?
Good. We also have our resident boxing expert, Tony Tornado Pennington, psychic Tom Padgett, who's our MMA guy.
Good evening, Lisa.
Oh, great. Good evening. I hope you guys can hear me okay, because sometimes you're a little fuzzy. How long is this Blog Talk Radio or is this live radio?
This is both live and
both. It's both. Oh, okay. And how long are we going to be on for?
As long as you want to be.
Okay. I am in the process of a lacrosse pool, so I figure we're probably good for maybe 15 minutes.
That's fine with us.
Okay, terrific. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So you're going to talk to us a little bit about UFC 157 and women's MMA, Ronda Rousey defeating Liz Carmouche. What are your thoughts on that whole main event?
Right, and we can talk about that. We can talk about Dana White never saying never to a woman. and hopefully the potential growth that this opens the door for more women.
All right. Well, give us a little background on yourself first. Tell us what you've been doing, what you're up to, and what you're all about.
Well, I started this broadcast 5 years ago. I started with ESPN, AM 1600, here in Denver, when we were the flagship station of all of our sports teams. And it was something very new for ESPN to have that female voice doing sports radio. It had never been done before. On ESPN, as well as, you know, other than somebody just being, you know, a talking head, you know, a reader. So I really wanted to create a show that was not a dummy down for women, but something that, you know, if you weren't completely comfortable with sports, that's okay. You know, I was going to kind of help you through it, and whatever I didn't know, I was going to bring on the expert. So it's been a great ride. I'm now with my Sports Radio, the flagship station for the Avalanche and the Nuggets, who, of course, absolutely embarrassed Carmelo Anthony last night when they were in town, and the Mammoths, which is lacrosse, and the Rapids, which is soccer, and they won the U.S. Cup, I believe, back in 2011. And so it's been great. You know, my tag is bringing women over to the lighter side of sports and men over to the lighter side of women, because I think sports is really a universal language. It touches everybody, whether you love it or whether you hate it. Everybody is involved in sports somehow. So I just thought it was a great opportunity to take it and kind of think outside of the box.
Awesome. So what do you think about women's mixed martial arts and how long it's taken to sort of break into the mainstream here?
Well, you know, they say the only people who like change are wet babies. And when you're bringing women into something that's pretty physical, a little messy, you know, physically messy, that there could be blood, there could be broken noses. You know, a woman with black eye and bruises and whatnot does not, you know, or bloody noses, does not bode well. You know, I think many sports fans would rather see a woman in the ring as your ring girl, not as your athlete. But I also feel that, you know, not to get all, you know, Title IX on you, because I know that relates to college, but looking at from the professional standpoint, I feel that everybody, I mean, you know, this is also even why they created the Paralympics. Everybody should have a chance to participate and compete, if you have the goods to make it that far. Now, if you go back to Dana White, who back in 2011, when he was actually here in Denver, when we were putting on a UFC between Bones and Ray, he had said, there will never, ever be a woman stepping into my octagon, ever. And so, you know, what changed his mind? I don't really know. Was it just, you know, the push on Ronda? Was it her stats? Was it her stamina? Was it her her drive, you know, her drive to succeed? I don't know what changed his mind. Maybe you have a better idea than I do. But I'm awfully glad he did. You know, I think it's great for Ronda. I think it's great for Liz. You know, even though she didn't take the title, it's, you know what, they are both very firmly on the map. And, you know, it's just like in the world of football, you know, Peyton Manning helps other guys be better on the team. You know, I think Ronda helped Liz be a better fighter. So I think it's great. I think the door is open. Even if it's just cracked, it's open.
And how do you feel that developed from here as far as, you know, with the UFC already bringing other women in, already announcing future women's fights, now that there's a whole new women's MMA league, Invictus, it seems like he's being very flexible with them moving back and forth, whereas he's not doing that with the males in the UFC, so he's really serious about it all of a sudden. How big do you think it's going to get with him pushing it like that?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think it's going to get too big, because I don't think, as far as from a participation standpoint, I think that there will be, the interest will probably grow faster than the participants, just because I don't think that there's many women out there who can physically handle everything that it takes to be an MMA fighter, to be in the UFC. So, I'm submitting a lot of papers on that, but I definitely see the interest, particularly in the male population. I don't think women really like to watch women fighting, but I think men like to watch women fighting, whether it's boxing or wrestling or you know, whatever. So I think, as I said earlier, I think the door is definitely open. Does it open the door for women in many other sports? You know, absolutely. You know, you look at Danica Patrick, first woman to get the pole position. She led, you know, the race for three laps under the green flag. Unfortunately, as the race ended, she ended up, I think, at one point she was third, and then in the last lap she slipped back to sixth. But, you know, there's so many great opportunities, and I think there's just, you know, occasionally the woman who will come out of the shadows and kind of set herself apart, you know, from everybody else. Number two, you have to look at somebody like, you know, Lauren Silberman, who kind of made a farce of herself with the NFL, you know, with the combine. And she really ended up not being a true kicker, even though she was an incredible soccer player at Wisconsin. Very smart girl, getting her master's from MIT. She ended up just kind of, I don't know, it seems like she kind of pulled the wool over everybody else's eyes, you know, when you're kicking 14 yards and here you are, you know, in front of, on a world stage, under the premise of going out as the first NFL kicker, and you just totally, you know, for lack of a better term, which I won't say on radio, you totally deceive everybody. And I think
she
put a black mark on yourself as well.
She had an injury, she claimed, I think.
I'm sorry?
Injury, she claimed. I thought I heard.
Injury? Well, do you have that injury as soon as you kick? Or did you maybe have a hamstring, you know, or thigh injury or a groin pull before you kicked?
Right.
I mean, you don't have an injury, put yourself out there and kick 14 yards. When you're a soccer player, I mean, if you're as good of a soccer player as she was deemed to be, you should be able to kick the ball all the way. I mean, even the soccer ball, you should be able to kick it from one goal to the other. So the 14 yards was kind of, I don't know. I mean, and then, you know, they say there's a hidden agenda that she was doing it to promote a business of hers and kind of put her name on the map. But do you promote, you know, it's kind of like the bait and switch. See, now they're saying, well, it's equal opportunity offender. Women And women athletes and male athletes can be just as deceiving. Isn't sports great? So I didn't take too kindly, but unfortunately, you got to call it like you see it.
Right. And what do you think about this big story that's been going all over the news? I even saw it on CNN the other day about this transgender athlete down there.
Oh my gosh. Was that the wrestler?
No, she's an MMA fighter.
Oh, she's an MMA fighter. Okay. Yeah, in Florida, I believe, right?
Yeah, she won her last...
Right. Well, she didn't... I think the issue was she did not disclose.
Right.
But at the same time, I think, was there something where she was going under the guise of, well, I hadn't finished doing all my, you know, my hormone therapy or whatever, and so I didn't have to disclose. I mean, I think it's very unfair, you know, and it just goes to show, you know, whether you're Lansdowne strong or you're the female, you know, coming out of the shadows for the first time to try to get people's attention. You know, we seem to have lost the purity of sports back in the day of Jesse Owens. You know, and I would go back, you know, somebody had asked me months ago, Lisa, if you could talk to any former athlete, dead or alive, who would it be? And I said, I'd like to go back to Jesse Owens. I think he is the purest form of what athleticism truly should be, from an ethical standpoint, from a passionate standpoint. And that's, you know, that was just kind of my take on it. I think deception is never okay. Even if you end up being clear, there's always going to be that shadow of a doubt hanging over people and the way they feel about you and what they think about you. And if you're just somebody who's trying to get started and make a name for yourself, that isn't the way to get started, casting shadows of doubts over people's minds when they hear.
Right. Anybody else got any questions? I feel like I'm hogging this
one.
Hogging is good.
Well, whenever we get a boxing guest on, Rich always yells at me for hogging all the spotlight time. But no, with regards to, you know, females in combat sport or in sports in general, I remember back in it was late 1995. I was in college, and this is and it just happened to be coincidental that it worked out this way. We had the first girl tryout for the boxing team at Lock Haven University. And I remember the coach was kind of an old school guy, you know, Dr. Cox, and he took her outside and he had about a 20-minute discussion with her saying, you know, is this what you want to do? Are you sure you want to do this?
Because the guys are going to take you down and they could possibly grab you in an inappropriate place. And so, you know.
That's kind of hard to do with gloves on, though. Because it's a straight boxing, you know. Mm-hmm. So she was asking, "Is this something you want to do?" And she adamantly said yes. And this girl, her name was Melissa. She stuck with the team. She was part of the first college female bout that year. I helped walk her to the ring, and then. Later that year, which happened to be funny, so we're getting ready for the regionals now. They weren't going to have any female bouts to regionals because there was only two or three females in college boxing at the time. We had one, mm-hmm. and I forget the other teams that had other ones. There weren't going to be any at the regionals. Well, the week before the regionals was the big Mike Tyson-Frank Bruno rematch. And that happened to be the big coming out party of Christy Martin when her and Deidre Gogarty beat the living hell out of each other on pay-per-view. And it just happened to be, you know, it was a Mike Tyson fight, so there was a lot of viewers out there. And Don
King, boy, that's a great opening gig.
Yeah, Don King, put this bout on there, and it stole the show. And then it's like, you know, this whole female boxing thing, you know, it isn't as crazy as it seems 6 months ago, you know?
No, it's a matter of getting people used to the idea and that, exactly. You know, they may be a small handful, but they're a mighty handful and they're not making it. The main thing is to make sure that people are not making a joke of the sport. They need to take it seriously and they kind of have to try a little harder than, quote unquote, the guys, because that's what they have to do. You know, same thing in sports talk radio. I don't really know who's on the air, but not who are actually, you know, producing and writing and doing their own show. And so I have to try just a little bit harder, you know, to get the bigger guests, to get the best guests. And I think sports is the very same way, especially boxing.
Yeah,
well, guys, it's been a pleasure. I really thank you so much. I got to get a bunch of lacrosse kiddos to back home and get their homework done. It's 7 o'clock here in Mahi City.
All right. Well, we've enjoyed having you. Do you want to give a shout out to anybody or tell us where we can people can find you online?
Absolutely. Yes. Sunday morning, Mountain Time, 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern, 10 to noon. You can stream me on milehighsports.com, and it's called Live with Lisa, and it's every Sunday morning. And, of course, when you're in the Mile High area, it's AM 1510 and FM 93.7. You can follow me at Lisa Sports Talk, and I have a website, livewithlisa1510.com.
Thanks for joining us, and you have a good night.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
So, there we have it. Talked about a lot of different sports issues. I was just going to tell the story I like to bring up every time we talk about women in combat sports, and how every time I've seen women fight in a cage or in the ring, it always seems like they're fighting for more than just themselves. They're fighting for sort of all women everywhere. So, I've always enjoyed that about watching women try to break into sports like boxing and MMA and even wrestling, where I first kind of got that soft spot for women in sports, combat sports, because I wrestled in high school with a girl who ended up wrestling for Harvard. And very, very tough little girl. She just everybody around at one point just got to the point where she could hack it with some of the men, and there you have it. She went on to Harvard and became the first woman to wrestle for Harvard.
And, you know, I think Lisa brought up a good point when she said the women have to try a little harder. And what I noticed with some of the ones that came into Strong Style, that they were very technical. And I think maybe women understand, you know, at a very deep level that they're not going to out-muscle the guys. So, therefore, they tend to really focus on technique. And I enjoyed rolling with them because they just a lot of times would do things just the way they were supposed to do it. And I think that carries over into a lot of sports with women.
Well, we know we've seen in training men get the better of some men in MMA and all that kind of stuff, but I just kind of had a thought. I wonder if we'll ever see a battle of the MMA on a major level. I know I've seen it online where a woman fought a guy in MMA type, I don't know who was pulling MMA, but she ended up beating him, and man, talk about embarrassing for the guy. But
well, yeah, that would be a no-win situation, though, really, when you think about it. I mean, the guy wins the fight, oh, you beat up a girl, but, you know, and what I wish, if we had a little more time with Lisa, I was going to see what she felt about women's boxing, and, you know, because it seems like back in the late 90s, women's boxing seemed to be getting some momentum back then. And it just seems like things...
What is it at the Christy Martin game in the Don Kim show?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
we had that.
That reminded me of an interview we had, sort of a back and forth between Iceman John Scully and I think Ken Shamrock, talking about women boxing and in combat sports in general. And Ken Shamrock was all for it, and John Scully was just like, you know, you expect women to be pretty all the time, and you don't want to see them get bashed in the face.
Well, I mean, not all of them. I mean, come on. But, you know, it seems like back then we had Layla Ali, and, you know, obviously the big mega fight with Jacqueline Frazier was sort of anticlimactic. But then we had Ann Wolfe, Vonda Ward. And I have a few stories about Vonda. She's a local gal. But,
Real baby, Maureen Shea.
Yeah.
I think she's still
she was a beast. And it just seems like we're just not getting the publicity, or I don't know, maybe I'm missing it somewhere. I don't know if women are going into MMA rather than boxing, but it just seems like women...
It's kind of a problem, just like it's happened in... you got Ronda Rousey making her debut in the cage. Next day, they're trying to recruit her for the movies.
Mm-hmm.
These women automatically become stars, not only because they're dominant in a particular sport, but they're at the top of their game in a sport that nobody would ever expect a woman to be able to compete in. So they become such a huge story that the publicity generated around them makes it easy for them to just walk away at any time. They get a million different opportunities coming from left and right and everywhere because everybody wants to associate with somebody like that who's just an automatic hero just for being at the top of their game instead of just being at the top of your game in a regular sport. You're there as a woman in a male-dominated sport. You're able to do that. So I think that's why we've seen a lot of these women just go on to bigger and better things or, you know, be able to leave boxing and still be comfortable with whatever money they can make in another few years or eight times. You know, it's easier to do for... it's kind of like the way I looked at college boxing sometimes. I mean, I know I shouldn't beat myself up about it. But I'm always thinking to myself, you know, I'm not... I got a bronze medal in the Nationals, but it's not like, you know, the Olympics or Golden Gloves because, you know, there's only so many kids who were boxing in college. There's only so many colleges that were doing it. Women have the same landscape. You know, even though it's tougher for them, they have to train with men and all that kind of stuff, they have such less competition. It's not necessarily, at this point, you know, low-level competition, but it's not like the men's field, which is huge.
No, yeah, yeah.
All around the world.
Exactly. It's not a deep talent pool.
Exactly. So it's obviously still a huge deal, but at the same time, it'll be a bigger deal when there's more women to be at the top of your game. But you know, why would you want to go out and do that? Take punishment, take hits to the face your whole life as a woman if they're going to lure something else in front of you where you don't have to take punches. You can just do it fake on camera and get paid way more. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, and I think Gina Carano came to that, too. Yeah.
But it is what
the other thing I wanted to say about the college pretty good point. I mean, the weight classes between like 147 and about 190 were very competitive because that's average weight for, you know, an adult male, you know, especially one that's training and cutting weight. So, yeah, you're always going to be fighting almost every week, and you're always going to have somebody in your weight class in the regionals, and definitely people in your weight class in the nationals. So for me, it's like, yeah, I'm going to go. I went to the nationals two times. I could have went my sophomore year, and if they would have brought me out to Reno with the team, and I would have had my gear, one kid medically forfeited, I would have stepped into a spot, and I would have fought that year too. But they hadn't booked me, and unfortunately, they didn't know it was going to medically forfeit. But going back to that, I fought every year in the regionals at least once, sometimes twice. But yeah, it was the lower weights. It was like 140 and below, and usually heavyweight. There wasn't always a lot of great heavyweight. These kids were playing football or basketball or whatever. That's where teams like Air Force and Navy had advantages when I was there, and now I think is spreading over to Army too, because they require.
Now that you mentioned those two schools and the military aspect in general, I guess in some ways it was a lot tougher than it would have been in Golden
Gate. Well, not the fact that it was a lot tougher, but the fact that look, you get Navy or Air Force, and they require, you know, their students and freshmen to take like a semester of boxing.
You get to cherry pick
basically your entire student base there. You get a kid out there, you're like, oh, Jesus Christ, we get this kid here at 119 pounds, he's pretty goddamn good. Hey, guess what, kid, you're on the boxing team now. Now, I'm new kid that full-time All-American. You know, the U.S. Nationals for you did not have one fight in the regionals. All he had to do was make weight 4 years in a row of 119 pounds with the Nationals every year. The worst example I've ever seen, and Tom, I don't know if you ever heard this one. I know I told Rich. Rich, you're familiar with Westfield University up in Massachusetts? Westfield had a team my freshman year, and I don't know if they still do. I don't think they still do. They had a team my freshman year. In fact, the first kid I beat was a freshman with a Westfield kid. Heavyweight, you know. Actually, he outweighed me by about 20-some pounds, and I fought him, and I beat him. And Westfield had two kids. One kid was 112 pounds. One kid was 119 pounds. Now, I remember at a show, they did like a round-robin sparring session with a kid from our team, the two-time All-American. Josh basically dropped both of them. He dropped the 112-pounder, and he dropped the 119-pounder. Josh goes to the Nationals at 125. At the time, all these kids had to do for the regionals was get on the scale. So basically, 0-1, they both get on the scale, and they get a free trip right to Nationals because nobody's in the weight class.
Wow.
Each of them get that. Each of them get the Nationals. So, Tom, it gets worse. Each of them get the Nationals, and they each happen to be in a weight class with two other people.
Mm-hmm.
So they each get on the scale. They make weight the first night. They both draw the bye. Now, they're fighting for the national title. The national title of college boxing. By basically not winning a fight.
Yeah.
They each make it to the national finals, and I think one drew an Air Force kid. And Rich will tell you, Air Force is a very competitive college team. Eddie Wishers is still the coach, and they won the national title a lot of years. Pretty good boxers out there. So if these kids get knocked out in the first or second round. So basically, now they're walking out of there. They are the national runner-ups. All Americans, 0-2, both of them. Two knockout losses.
Wow. Talk about a shallow talent pool. Wow.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
That is absolutely amazing.
In college boxing, in the region, which I know had El Dorf, Santa Clara, I'm trying to remember who else was in the western region, they generally had pretty good competition in the lower weight because you had out in California a pretty heavy Hispanic population. They could feel the team, everybody in every weight from 112 to heavyweight. Because they can cherry pick. Same thing with Navy. Navy had some good fighters in low weight classes. But when you got to the Northeast region, and I can tell you every year going to the Nationals, okay, it was 112, if we had somebody to weigh in, was basically a walkover. 119 was a walkover. And I think two of the 4 years I was there, 125 was a walkover. So your actual bout at regionals didn't start for 132.
Wow.
And of the 4 years I was there, I'm trying to remember, first year heavyweight was a walkover. Second year there was a heavyweight bout. And I think the second 2 years, I think two out of the 4 years it was a heavyweight bout. But the other years it was a walkover. Yeah.
I feel better about my medal.
You should, because first of all, I mean, you fought at 185, which is a very competitive weight class, and I know that because I fought in the very same weight class, and I know everybody that was in that weight class with us. And I'll tell you, in fact, I have my, I just broke it out the other day because I had to do some research on something. Dr. Cox used to make us a scrapbook every year with all the results of all the bouts of that year and any articles that, you know, were written, not just by the Lock Haven papers, but by other papers and letters that got sent to us. He would make us this big scrapbook with photos and all. And I remember going to the Nationals in 98. Now, I had gotten unjustly eliminated in the regionals. fighting a kid that Rich and I both fought, Jesse Bond, who was unorthodox, to say the least. He basically was with us. He used to like to hold, and you know, it's a very difficult guy to get a rhythm with. I beat him the first time, and I felt I beat him worse the second time, but in his home gym, I don't get the decision. I'm sure you guys have heard that 1,000 times from me about that fight. But now we're getting ready to the Nationals, and I get picked with a spot. So I'm looking at the 7 other fighters in the Nationals that year, and I'm saying, okay, we got Jesse Bond. I've already fought him twice. I know what he brings to the table. I can take him. And this time, I know what I got to do to take him out. We're not in his gym. Okay, let's put Jesse Bond to the side. We got Michael Jordan. I said, I've already fought Jordan. I've already beaten Jordan. And he is stepping up so much in weight. I was dying to fight him at the regionals because he had just come off like being sick. And he was so underweight that he had to put on 7 pounds. He had to drink like 2 gallons of water before he stepped on the scale. I mean, wow, pretty fighter. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to make this kid throw up in the ring. I can't wait for it. So I'm going to put Jordan over to the side. I'm like, now we got Art Terry, who Rich beat in the regionals. And I said, I've seen Art fight. Art's a very aggressive fighter. He likes standing close. He likes to, you know, hit to the body. I said, he's a very tough guy, but he's very hittable. I said, I've seen Art fight. I know it's not going to be an easy fight, but Art's beatable. Put him to the side. 3 guys already down. Okay, fine. Now we got Brian Kerr, who Rich ended up beating in the Nationals. Brian Kerr, I fought out in Reno, and I fought a stupid fight. You know, I tried to go toe-to-toe with him, even though he was bigger and heavier than me.
Yeah,
I said, he's slow. He's easy to hit. I'm not going to make the same mistakes again. I'm going to murder him this time. Put Brian Kerr to the side. Okay, now we're getting even better. And then there was another kid, he was a kid from Kentucky, and I'm forgetting, but there was a kid from Lock Haven that had beaten him and beat him decisively. I said, well, shit, if the kid from Lock Haven can beat him and beat him decisively, I can beat him with one arm tied behind my back and my eyes blindfolded. I said, put him to the side. I said, there were 2 guys in that weight class I had no scouting on. The guy that would be eventual 3-time champion, this kid Mark Sletton from Air Force, who was 6'6" or 6'7", and Rich. I said, if I cannot draw one of those 2 guys in the first round, I said, I'm going to win the national title. Because what's going to happen is, say I drew the kid from Kentucky. In fact, Jordan ended up knocking him out in 1 or 2 rounds in the Nationals. I annihilate him. Now I'm in the second round. And then now I would either had a chance to have scouted and have scouted this 6'7" Air Force kid. And I would have been able to formulate a game plan. If I would have went in there before that, I went in there against the Air Force kid with no game plan. I'm figuring this kid's 6'6", 6'7". He's going to try to ollie me. He's going to try to stay on the outside and use his height and his reach, which he did to an extent, but he was really good at almost, if you got in close, he would kind of pull it to the side and get on the side of you, and he would push you off, and then he would try to hit you from a distance with just a bunch of straight punches, and they were coming quick. He was a lot quicker than I thought, and by the time the third round came, I was so far behind on points, I'm like, shit, I have to knock him out. So I went in, and I just started winging everything I had. I could barely reach his head. And I finally catch him with a left hook with about 10 seconds left. And he, if I could have done this 2 rounds ago, I would have had him. But it took me that long to figure him out. But the whole point of that whole rambling, babbling nonsense that I just said was to tell Rich how competitive that it is in National Collegiate Boxing. You know, granted it ain't the Golden Gloves, and granted it ain't, you know, amateur amateur championships, but still pretty goddamn competitive.
Yeah.
Well, I guess you can say the same thing about women's boxing and MMA. I mean, it has its own angles of competitiveness that male sports don't have.
The same way
that the NCBA had advantages for guys like us coming up over the Golden Gloves. Because, you know, these military guys, like you said, I know the Air Force discontinued their mandatory bar. But it still does it, and I know Naval Academy still does it because they had a women's fight on their brigade championships this year. And they mentioned that she came from that class. So, you know, yeah, it definitely does add a new angle to it when you put it in that perspective. But anyway, let's get on with the show. We got a bunch of new stories. This one is kind of funny, too, just staying on the boxing topic. I don't know if you guys heard about this, but this guy lived out the fantasy of athletes everywhere on Monday. Actually going to the neighborhood of somebody on Twitter who was tormenting him.
Oh, yeah, Varsity. Yeah, this is a great story. This is, I love it.
And he's a former professional soccer player, which you would think, you know, judging on the popularity of soccer, especially in Kingdom where he was a player, you know, that's a sport with a lot of scrutiny. So you probably carry a lot of those fans with you wherever you go to another sport. So anyway, he got a series of taunting tweets from a user named The Master after he lost his English lightweight title to Shane Singleton last weekend. And one of the messages from Jimmy Ob 88 was, "What's funny? You put so much effort and sacrificed all that time and failed to defend your Mickey Mouse title." The keyboard warrior soon had the wind taken out of his sails when Woodhouse apparently tracked down the user's address and drove to his street, believed to be Sheffield in the northern English county of Yorkshire. And upon his arrival, Woodhouse tweeted a photograph of the street sign stating, "Right, Jim Bob, I'm here. Someone tell me what number he lives at, or do I have to knock on every door?" And at that point, the clearly and understandably flustered Twitter troll decided discretion was the better part of valor and hastily retreated into a neutral corner of cyberspace. Something his thoughts were merely intended in jest. And the Woodhouse took off, never met the guy. But by the time he got home, his actions had gone viral. So the exchange prompted a flood of social media attention for the 33-year-old who actually left soccer at the age of 26. Even though he was getting higher pay for it than he was able to generate in boxing. And even former world Ricky Hatton messaged Woodhouse to voice his amusement, as did notorious English soccer player Joey Barton, who now plays for Marseille in French. Barton has routinely... Oh, wait a second. Oh, slow down. Barton routinely became involved in Twitter arguments in the past, and he went so far as to describe Woodhouse as my hero. And I think a lot of professional athletes would see it the same way because, I've seen it live. I've probably seen it, gone to a sporting event and heard how the crowd gets on the opponent's team. And, I've sat right behind the bullpen a couple times in Yankees-Red Sox games, and I've heard some of the Yankees players get some real bad taunts from the fans. And they get hurt times, too, so. Understand why this guy would follow the guy to his own neighborhood and put him on notice like that.
I like that phrase, taunting tweets. Yeah, that's all. I'm going to remember that one. Taunting tweets. Oh, classic.
So, Woodhouse, he's sure that it's not subject himself to that crap in the first place. Here's back to MMA. Here's a good story about Stephen Bonner. His situation has changed completely. This is a guy who sort of came out of retirement he hadn't fought in so long to fight Anderson Silva. But he's finally breaking his silence about the steroid use. 5 months after being busted for drostanolone after facing Anderson Silva in that fight, which he lost. But he did all right. You know, he's one of the people that's lasted a little bit longer than some of Anderson Silva's previous opponents. So, you know, it wasn't the greatest performance of all time, but he definitely went out with a bang. But since that happened, he's been on the outs with the UFC, hasn't talked to Dana White at all, and he actually had some important and lucrative opportunities there to stay associated with the company before this happened. And now he's sort of coming out and explaining exactly what the circumstances were, which doesn't minimize his use of steroids in the first place, but it does kind of put it in perspective. So I thought I'd discuss this one. And it's been his first public interview since the October 2012 match. And it was on Monday's edition of the MMA. But he said, after being shelved for months and being advised to retire by UFC President Dana White, he gave up on the hopes of closing out his career with a major fight. So in that time, Bonner had undergone a pair of stem cell procedures on his injured knee. 2 months after the second stem cell procedure, he decided he wanted to return to the gym to get in shape and help some of his friends train. In doing so, he made the decision to obtain some chemical assistance, he called it, I guess. Believe it or not, there are some therapeutic uses to some of the banned substances, he said. Bottom line, I wanted to get my strength back. I was very weak. My body didn't feel good. My joints didn't feel good. That was my goal. But then, out of the blue, he got the call that he never thought was coming. After about 10 months without a fight, he was being asked to compete against Anderson Silva. Faced with that opportunity, he looked at the calendar and then the scale. He had 3 weeks to train and 35 pounds to lose. So, drostanolone is one of those drugs that they say is used during cutting cycles. And he said, if you think that he would intentionally take steroids when he had that much weight to lose to make the light heavyweight division's 205-pound limit, you are crazy. He said, I'm not a stupid person. Of course, I know I'm going to get tested. I've got 3 weeks to train for the fight and 35 pounds to lose. And you really think after all that, I'm going to take something that's detectable for a month? That makes no sense. Absolutely none. He said that because he'd stopped taking the drugs a few weeks before the call to fight Silva, he had been told by every expert I talked to that it would be out of his system by the time he faced Silva on October 13th. But it wasn't. This is the part where things go downhill. Since that decision, drug test came out positive, his life has been difficult, at least on the professional side. And the wife, Andrea, recently welcomed their first child into the world, but that happy announcement was met with many rude and angry messages from those who took the opportunity to scold him for what he'd done. It also changed his relationship with UFC bosses Dana White and Lorenzo Fertitta, who have previously said Bonner would be in the UFC family for life. Since the positive test was announced, Bonner hasn't had a single conversation with them. He says, that was the hardest thing, too. You know, there's no way if I thought there was any possibility of it showing up that I would have taken the fight. I finally get the opportunity I've been begging for in vain so long. I thought I'd go out there and put on a better fight, but then stuff like this happened. It's like I came to his house and took a shit on his carpet. It just kills me. I'm like, come on, Damon, give me the opportunity. And then I make him look like that. I'm really sorry. Since then, Bonner has been mostly laying low. He says his business interests have struggled because people don't want to do business with me. I'm a bad name. Three appearances, namely for an organization called Carrots Fight, which provides special needs athletes opportunities in the martial arts. But even that, he says, was overshadowed by his drug test failure. So that's why he's been so quiet. And there's an interesting quote. I feel the best thing for me to do is to respectfully piss off. It's not sit there and go, oh, come on, Dana, give me another chance. I fucked up, and I'll put my tail between my legs and leave you guys alone for a while. As far as what's next for him, he doesn't know. He continues to spend time with his family, and this Friday he'll make a rare personal appearance at Haraz in Lake Tahoe. And despite his two surgical procedures, he's going to need another operation on his knee in the coming weeks. So at 35, he doesn't think he'll ever fight again. So it's one of those interesting stories. It's tough to have sympathy for a guy who uses steroids because of the stigma on the competitive advantage that people think that it provides. But the UFC and fighting in general, it's kind of a different thing. I mean, obviously in this situation, there's a lot of different aspects. He was not expecting to fight. And if you're not fighting and you take steroids to get over something, I mean, some of that steroid stuff is in traditional drugs. So there's some treatments for conditions involve steroids. So it does kind of put an interesting light on it. You know, you can't knock him for something where he wasn't even expecting to fight and didn't think it would show up on a test. But at the same time, you can't reward people for because their argument is, well, I got caught. I shouldn't have got caught. You know, I was using. But it is what it is.
I wonder if he had a prescription for those drugs. Did he? Was that, were they prescribed? Does it say?
I doubt it.
You see, because in my mind, I don't know if that's going to change the response, but I know in the minds of a lot of people, that would make everything legit, and I kind of scratch my head at that. I mean, if you're opposed to it, you're opposed to it, but it almost seems like, oh, well, a doctor prescribed it, so, you know, it's okay. But I didn't hear if anything was prescribed, so...
I think it was something that he got, you know, either on the black market or from some expert in the MMA circles who, you know, puts athletes through those type of programs or provides it. But I've never heard of it, that particular version being anything that is prescribed for any reason. All I've read about that, because so many guys have been busted for it in MMA, including, I think, not the only guys, but the woman there, Chris Cyborg Santos, has been tested positive for drostanolone. And it's basically, you know, for getting cut, basically, the bodybuilder started using it to get, you know, really lean with a lot of muscle. So... kind of explains that she's been using it for a while, why her physique is the way it is. But so, you know, it's a popular thing in MMA circles. So he realized, well, you know, I got to get in shape to try to make one last fight. I don't, you know, expect it any time in the near future. So I'm going to use this and I'm going to overcome injuries. And the same people have done, well, not the same people, but some people have done the same thing with TRT to use it to get over an injury. Does it make it right? I don't know. If everybody's not using it, yeah, it's a problem. But, you know, if you're in a situation where you're not expecting a fight, there is a little gray area that gives them. But it's just that stigma of steroids where it's kind of an interesting aspect of the game. If you're branded as a steroid user in some respects like this one, you're out. But what made me kind of pick this story up to talk about is you have a guy that's going to be fighting, just got another fight, Chris Lieben, who's been tested positive before. You've got a bunch of guys in the UFC still fighting who have been tested positive before. And just because Stephen Bonner happens to get nailed one time because he's fighting his last fight, he has to go through the stigma, but these other people are still working for the UFC. You know, so it's another one of those situations where there's a double standard. And, you know, those happen too often in the UFC. I hate to see it, too. Anyway, we got another big story about coming back to box. Juan Diaz is retired back in at the age of 27. He's a millionaire. Now he's coming back. captured three of the four major belts in the lightweight division by the time he was 25. But in June of 2011, he lost four of his last six fights and thought he had burned himself out. So he hung up the gloves during law school. But he said, I knew I wasn't giving it 110% anymore, and I wasn't training with the same fire. I needed that break. I took 2 years off to let my body rest and really think about what I wanted to do with my life. But on Friday, he announced his return to the ring, and his first comeback fight is scheduled for April 13th against Pepino Cuevas Jr., 69 at the American Bank Center in Corpus Christi. And
Pepino Cuevas Jr., what was his record again, Rich?
16-9 with 14 knockouts.
Wow. So it sounds like...
And while he was thinking about whether he wanted to go to law school, he actually was involved in some business ventures, including a trucking company during his time away from the ring. And had some risks and chaos involved in his ventures, but once they stabilized and evolved into viable operations, he found the day-to-day routines too mundane for his tastes. So he came back for these adrenaline rush and got back into the gym 3 months ago. And he's now under trainers Derwin Richards and Tim Knight. So he was doing pretty good with the businesses. He says last year alone I grossed $2.1 million with the company. So for those people that say, oh, he's coming back for the money, I'll gladly show them my books. He wants to equal, if not surpass, in his 30s what he accomplished in his 20s. The difference now, he said, is the maturity he has attained to know his limitations and adjust his style. He says when you're young, you think you can get away with it all. I'm smarter now. You're going to see the same action fighter as before, just a little more controlled and a little... So, we'll see. Tony, are you there?
Of course I'm still here.
Oh. I'm talking about boxing. I was like, what was that?
Can you hear me throw in a couple comments there?
Maybe your mic was shut down.
I think me and Tony are just reminiscing about Pepino Cuevas, the original, you know, some of
that. Yeah, we both said, when you said Pepino Cuevas, you guys said no shit. Then I said, oh, the apple said that he fell pretty far from the tree when he said his record. Then when you said Juan Diaz, I was like, no shit again. But hey, before we go any further, before I forget, a couple things I just wanted to quickly touch base on. I wanted to talk about the fight last Friday on ESPN. I want to talk about the preliminary fight on Saturday on hockey cards. Friday night from Atlantic City, main event, we had Emmanuel. You know, a good prospect. He's transformed. Joke for us. And it's funny, because the kid's 22 years old, and when me and Dave were actually training together, I think he was all of like 4. It just makes me feel so freaking old. We had Magomed Abusamov. We were talking about him last week. He had a fifth-round TKO over Victor Bisbal. That keeps his record perfect at 17-0 with 17 knockouts. He was a heavyweight fighter that absolutely annihilated Maurice Byram in 2 rounds and former title challenger Jamil McLean in 2 rounds. So we get a guy that's a complete knockout artist here. And he's not a small guy either. You figure he's 6'3". He weighed 226 for his fight last week. So, I mean, he's not as big as the Klitschko brothers, but we're not talking about a guy that's small either. And watching his fight with Maurice Byron last year, he impressed me. I mean, he had Maurice down and out in the first round, and it only took him a few seconds to finish him off in the second. And I had seen Maurice go 10 rounds with a very good Philadelphia prospect in Brian Bye-Bye Jennings. So we got a kid here, he's 31 years old, and he's only had 17 fights. So, I mean, he's got to get moving. He's been pro for about 4.5 years now. We got a guy, you know, that can, you know, really make some noise in this division. And on Saturday night, for the Hopkins fight, I really don't have anything else I need to say on that one. I think I broke it down pretty good as the show was starting. But we had Keith Thurman. Keith, one-time Thurman, another good prospect from Clearwater, Florida. He's now 20-0 with 18 knockouts. He had his first real big test of his career. He went 12 rounds with former world titleist Jan Zavik, and he won all 12 rounds on all three cards. There was a couple rounds I know Harold Letterman, but Thurman pretty much controlled the fight. He did make a few errors out there. Like, he was keeping his left hand kind of low, and Zavik was able to land a couple right hands over the top. And then he did show he slowed down a little bit in the later rounds. This is a guy that never had gone past 8 rounds in his career. So, you know, he had to go the full 12 for the first time, but he did it. So it was a nice little step up for him. And, you know, he's a good prospect. Not sure how far he's going to go, but he's got good punching power. And, you know, he's a prospect, you know, especially in the welterweight division. You know, I'm never going to complain. That's always a good hotbed for some good fights.
And what about Martin was shot in Philadelphia. Tony Martin shot Brotherly Love.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, once again, anytime, you know, you lose somebody in just a horrible, senseless violence is a bad thing. I did not know Tony Martin personally. I do remember watching him fight on USA, fought at the Blue Horizon a lot. He's a very popular fighter, never a world titleist, but he fought a good list of guys out there. I mean, his last fight was in 97, a unanimous decision loss to Julio Cesar Chavez. And basically what had happened is, and I don't have the whole story yet, but he was going to one of his rental properties, and I guess, I think he was going to evict somebody that wasn't supposed to be living there, or something along those lines, and or he was going to collect money, and he received a shot right there and killed. And it's sad. It really is. Senseless violence. That's really what's making, you know, any progress in this country almost impossible sometimes. And, you know, rest in peace to a good guy and a class act.
And he lost his last fight by decision to Julio Cesar Chavez in Vegas in 1997. He had a record 34 in his boxing career. Knockouts, native of St. Louis, who moved to Philadelphia to train in 85. Yeah. You know, the gun mentality, it's one thing if you actually need it for protection, but, you know, if you're walking around with it just to act tough,
You know what the problem is? I mean, a lot of people talk about, you know, they want to do regulations, they want to do this and that. But the problem is, no matter what you try to do out there, you're always going to have it where people are going to get them off the black market. The criminals will find a way to get them, which is what, you know, unfortunately, the person, the perpetrator here was. You know, the paid guys here, always going to get them, and unfortunately, that's That's the sad reality of what we live in today. And until they start making the punishments fit the crime, you know, people that, you know, commit these crimes are not going to be afraid of punishment. You know? I mean, a lot of these guys got all their boys going to prison. Shit, I'll go in there, I'll get free food, you know, three cots at a cob. I'll hang out with my boys 24/7. What do I care? What do I got to be on the street working for? Hell with that shit. It's easier on the inside for a lot of these guys. That's the mentality of them. It's easier on the inside. You know, so, I mean, until you start saying, okay, all right, take a seat in the chair and put this little thing on your head. We're going to run some electricity through you. Then maybe that'll open some eyes up and people aren't going to start to, you know, do this shit anymore because they're like, hey, or my dad always said, he's always a big proponent of public flogging. So you get people here out in the corner throwing drinks, whatever, you get them up, you flog them. Because that'll straighten some people out, you know, when you don't do a little tap on the wrist because it ain't scaring nobody no more.
Yeah, apparently back in the old days, you know, they used to put the people in those lock, stock, and barrels there. The device is. But you put your head and your arms in there and you lock the two boards together. I knew those things existed, but I didn't know the other half of the story.
I know what you're talking about. The things, you always see them in the old West.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't just you get put in the locked up position, but your neighbors were also supposed to come out and throw garbage at you. I guess that makes it even worse. And they can insult you, too, while you're locked up, of course. I can imagine how bad that scene would get. It was a particular grievous thing that the person did. Anyway, Herschel Walker, MMA, he's the Bernard Hopkins of MMA, I guess. He wants to come back.
I met him, right?
Where?
Where? Yeah, where? I met him at Westchester University, 1992, when he first signed with the Philadelphia Eagles.
He wants to go into the UFC for his last fight, one fight deal. And there's a story here about, will he be able to do that? I don't know why I'd consider it a freak show type of fight that he's not interested in. I don't know. I mean, getting to the point where we're running out of guys with small records in the UFC. You know, Dana White seems to be throwing everybody out who can't hang, so. There's no real opponents out there, I think, that you could throw Herschel Walker in with. Going to give him a competitive fight that's going to put him out with a loss. So, I don't know. I don't know if you can. You got to have him win the fight if you're going to put him into the last possible fight. And that, to me, it's kind of like a fix, almost. And I don't want to see that situation just to give him one last fight. But at the same time, I think it's great that he's still doing it at his age.
Down in Valley, actually in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, about 30 minutes from where I live. That's actually where I was last week when I started to get sick. It used to be the Valley Forge Convention Center, which is actually where I graduated high school from. That's where we had our graduation ceremony from high school. It has a nightclub a casino, and the nightclub has a mechanical bull. So as you saw, my mini post on Facebook last week, all I talked about was riding this goddamn bull, which I did a couple times, and I'll have some videos posted. I didn't break my neck, which I'm sure disappointed many of my friends. They were betting on that. Tomorrow night they're going to have a fight card there. Gentleman I was just talking about, Dave Price, he's going to be there. One of his fighters is in the card in the main event, so I'm going to get them to see him. I'm sure, a few of my other friends will be there from the fight game, which is great. I always love thinking a lot of my friends that I grew up with or I've known for a lot of years to these local fight cards where I know a lot of people, because then it makes me seem like I'm cooler than I really am. I took him to a fight card about 4 or 5 years ago in Oaks, Pennsylvania. And one of my old trainers was there. So he comes over and he's talking to me, and then he starts talking to these guys, and he's really building me up and everything and telling them, you know, how good of a fighter I was back in my day. And I'm like, yeah, come on, pump me up some more. Come on, pump me up some more. And these guys are like, oh, man, that was really cool to meet him and everything. I'm like, damn, right. And so then I love dragging my friends to these things. And I'm like, hey, so-and-so, come on over here. Remember that time we sparred in, like, 96? Yeah, man, I remember that. Oh, my God. Blah, blah, blah. And these guys get all impressed. Like, they haven't known me for 30 years, you know? But what was also funny was just recently I was going through some of my stuff here, and I started doing work for Fight News Unlimited back in 2007. Started talking to Rich me in 06, and then, hey, you want to come do something for me? Yeah, sure, fun. You know, I go to fight cards anyway. And at the time, you know, the new Alhambra, which became the Asylum, which is currently closed, hopefully just for renovations, they were doing fight cards every 2 or 3 months, and I was going to every one of them. The Blue Horizon was doing fight cards every 2 or 3 months, and I was going to every single one of them. And then I was finding, like, the National Guard Armory was having some fight cards every few months. I was going to them. I was going to a lot of stuff. And tomorrow night I'm going to see my friend Harry Yorgi. He's going to be fighting. I was kind of surprised because it's only about 7 weeks after his last fight, which he lost by TKO on Showtime. So I was a little bit surprised they moved him back in there that quick. I don't know the guy he's fighting. But I found one of my old, notebooks. So I broke it out. I was like, oh, my God, notes from fight cards I went to when I first started working for Fight News Unlimited in 2007. I'm like, oh, shit. Here's a Phoenixville High School fight card that Harry Yorgi main evented. I said, oh, my God, here's the fight card back in 07 that me and my dad went to when we sat at the Blue Horizon in the front row right behind Tex Cobb where Michael Spinks was in my seat. I said, oh, that's the one that I had a female fight on the card and the girl's mouthpiece landed in Spinks' lap. She served the bastard note for sitting in my seat. But I'm looking at all these fight notes from 2007. I'm like, oh, my God, how cool is this? And anybody else that would look at these, it just looks like doodling on a piece of paper because my handwriting sucks. It looks like basically chicken scratch. But me, I could look at them notes now and probably still write you an article about it.
Nice. Yeah, we go back a long time. Almost 6-7 years. Jeez.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first fight card I covered was the Blue Horizon card in January of 2007. And we went down there. This was right after you and I first started discussing. And they were like, hey, you want to do some writing for me? I'm like, yeah, that sounds kind of fun. I'll do it. I'm like, man, I haven't covered a fight in, I can't tell you how many years. So I went there, and I'm like, I'm going to write a rough draft of this and just to send it to him and see what he thinks. So I write this rough draft, I send it over to Rich, and a couple of days later, a day or so later, I get an email back, hey, here's the link to your article. What? Here's the article that you wrote. I said, you posted it? I said, it sucked, you know? I said, I'm going to get my feet wet again. He goes, all right, we'll get it up. It was some live results. Here it is. I think that's actually when you still had everything in your mind stage.
That was 2006, I think, was the first time I opened Fight News Unlimited as a website.
Okay.
So it was probably brand new.
Okay, I'm gonna throw a test out to Tommy. I said that Tom's only been with us a short while. You know,
okay.
I'm gonna send him my article tomorrow night. Now, this is what my crap looks like, and I actually remember this fight because I'm the Rain Man, but it was a fight between a guy named Blackwell, which I think was Jules Blackwell, and a fighter named Hunter, which is Eric Hunter, which is ended up being a really good fighter. So next to Blackwell, I put ST. And then I was writing in the first round, chicken scratching, that lunged and slugged, and Hunter, sharper and, you know, more potential, it looks like. And so the second round, Black Gold slipped and hit on way down, end of round, and then Hunter landed devastating counters. And the third round for Black Gold was tried to survive, KO'd at round's end. Hunter, sharpshooting, big left hook. I actually turned that into a full three-round article. So, one, two, three, four, about those 20 words.
Yeah, it, sometimes that's all it takes, because when you're covering it live, you can't write out too much. And I think that just comes with experience, just a few words here and then it all clicks.
Yeah, and it always helps to practice, too. I used to go to freaking, you know, two-hour-long meetings when I first started in the newspaper business. You know, you'd get sent to the night meetings that the reporters didn't want to go to. So you'd sit there and try to figure out, you know, what's the most important thing that they're saying? I need to write that. I got to get a quote here, a quote there. And you learn to write real quick and come up with your own shorthand.
Yeah.
I think, many people learn shorthand, the official shorthand today. I think they just kind of do it on their own.
I'll tell you what was fun. I went to a fight card about a year and a half ago down at the National Guard Armory in Northeast Philadelphia. And it was me and my dad and this kid, Jeff, that I'm training. He's actually supposed to come back and start training with me again. We haven't worked out together in the fall. He's going to start coming back. He won't want to come back this but it was me, my dad, his kid Jeff, and his father. So of course I'm introducing Jeff to some of the fighters that I know there. And this kid, who was 17 years old at the time, he's wide-eyed as can be, and he's excited as can be. He's meeting these guys, and they're talking to him, being real nice to him and everything, because he's being trained. And, well, the one fight was a right-handed fighter and a southpaw, and you could tell when the fight started, it wasn't going to go long. So I wanted to get a couple pictures of each fight to include with the article. So I throw out my camera, and I'm kind of watching the fight through my lens, and I just happen to blankly snap a punch, which happened to be the knockout punch. And so I said, man, that was a good right hand. And this kid just turned to me and goes, it was a double right hand. I said, no shit. He landed two short right hands, and that's when he dropped them on. I said, okay. And I marked that down, double right hand. So I include that in my article, and I sent it to, you know, some people I know. And one guy is a veteran writer, J.R. Jowett, who I've known, because he still is a judge for college boxing. And he goes, wow, I'm really impressed. You were one of the few writers that noticed that was a double right hand. I told Jeff, I was like, hey, Jeff, I said, I just stole credit for what you saw.
Good eye. Anyway, we got a couple more big stories to chat about here. Wall Street Journal is actually putting out a lot of articles lately on boxing for some reason. This week they've had two boxing links in the Google Alerts. One, we've already talked about the headgear going away from amateur boxing. I wasn't able to access that full article, but the one that I did look at that they did have the full text of was that they did a study at some university. Smiling, and he got beat in his first fight. So I guess that kind of explains that. But basically, they're saying that the people that had no emotion whatsoever were more likely to win their fights. But people who smiled were not. So kind of an interesting little scientific Jack Johnson, even after the United States Senate and House both voted unanimously for a resolution to pardon the champion of the world and a very polarizing figure, the guy that the expression the Great White Hope actually comes from, because he wanted to field a competitor who would actually get into the ring with him and beat him, but he had to be white. It was a very racially charged country back then. So they ended up getting him in a traffic stop for they arrested him, and they had a year in jail. Over a year in jail. He was born in 1878 in Galveston, Texas. He's the son of two former slaves, but his parents made sure he and all five of his brothers and sisters learned how to read and write. He eventually made it on the boxing circuit and won the World Colored Heavyweight Championship in 1903. 5 years later, on the day after Christmas, which happens to be Boxing Day, Johnson became the first African-American boxing heavyweight champion of the world, defeating Canadian Tommy Burns in Sydney, Australia. This has been getting a lot of, actually, media attention, because there's been so many senators behind this. Harry Reid just joined the list. He actually is a former boxer. John McCain has sympathies for boxing, one that's also called MMA human cockfighting, but always been a friend of boxing. William Bo Pound is actually from my neck of the woods, Massachusetts, and Representative Peter King, they put out a resolution to pardon Johnson 100 years after his conviction. And Obama didn't pull the trigger on this and do the right thing during his first term, but they thought that they could get him to reconsider it the second term. But the real reason doesn't seem to have anything to do with race or whether he really did it or not, but actually the fact that he's dead, which kind of boggles the mind why they couldn't just do this without an investigation. But apparently the reason why the problem he's dead is such a big deal is because the office that's responsible for doing the investigations to result in pardons actually feels better working on cases of people who need pardons while they're alive, because they feel that it's nothing that's going to affect the person that they're pardoning. It's just his family members that are still alive, maybe, or, the people that looked up to him. That's not important enough, so it has to be, the priority has to be for them, for people who are alive. But I don't know, I think it's just a signature on a piece of paper, and that's all it should be.
Hey, but who says Congress can't get things done bipartisan, right? There's proof right there.
Well, we'll see. It hasn't been done yet.
Well, it's true. Okay. I'm getting ahead of myself. But my crystal ball says it will be done.
Yes, it should be. All right. Well, Second Tom says it's going to be done.
That's it. You know it.
But President Obama never explained why he didn't pardon Johnson when he unanimously asked him to do so. The senators and congressmen pushing for the pardon are apparently hoping that this newly reelected President Obama will see it differently, 100 years after Jack Johnson's conviction. It's up to the first African-American heavyweight champion. Whether to pardon the first African-American heavyweight champion is up to the first African-American president. So we'll see what happens, but great champion is great. That bad of a guy at all. He was demonized in a lot of ways, but he was just outspoken and not afraid to speak his piece, and fight the best. I don't see any reason why Obama shouldn't pardon him. It's the last thing I have. You guys got anything else? The Fighter, if you watched it last night, you would know that Zach Cummings got beat by Dylan Andrews. It was a pretty good fight. Started out pretty competitively, but then once Dylan Andrews got on top and figured out his advantage there with elbows, it was all over. He just basically got to the position where he was doing the same thing that was done to him in the first part of the first round, and he did it twice, did it at the end of the first round and then almost all through the second round.
Yeah, so I think Cummings really has to work on his jiu-jitsu and his sweeps and reversals. He just couldn't seem to mount anything from the guard.
Then we have the new fight. So the guy's coming out of the woodwork. One of our former guests, actually. We had him on a recorded conversation. But big boy Bubba McDaniel got the call to come back from defeat in his first fight. He's going to face Kevin Casey, which is a guy he called out. So, you know, he thinks he matches up well with him. We'll see who wins. But this one kind of made me think because they showed flashes of the hospital again. And
mm-hmm.
as I said, I did some detective work. I got the advanced screening of this whole show, this season. And they edited it a little bit for the real airing of these episodes where they showed the guy going into the ambulance. We saw that a bunch of times, but we never actually saw that footage where it happened, right? We just saw the clip of ambulance. And it was kind of intertwined with Dana White saying, oh, this is the best knockout I've ever seen on Tough or anywhere else. And then the guy goes in the ambulance. But the dude ended up going into the hospital, but they didn't show the clip of him going into the ambulance. So they're going to use that clip at some point. And I think it might be at this fight because one thing I know is the guy's face was black when he went in. And the footage that I saw on the advanced screening, they edited it out later so you couldn't tell. But one of the black guys on this show is going to go into an ambulance. So it could be this fight. And they've kind of talked about the hospital situation there. So this might be a very explosive episode where, you know, you're going to see some crazy fighting.
Yeah, and I think it's very intriguing because, you know, Casey, for someone that had trained that much with the Gracies, now he could have just had an off night in his fight, but he just could not seem to get to anything going that night at all. And
Chael Sonnen just was like, it wasn't him, you know, and he was even saying it himself. I didn't feel like it was me in there. I just didn't have it. So we'll see. But
yep.
We got our 60-second warning, so we got to go. But good luck to all the fighters next week on that show. We'll see who wins. And we'll definitely have a new guest next week for everybody, somebody from MMA or boxing probably. We're actually still looking for DeMarcus Corley to get on the show. Chop Chop, a good boxer mm-hmm. for Tony to talk to.
And yeah, I'll talk to anybody.
That's all for us.
All right, guys, let's enjoy the fights this weekend. We've got a lot of action.
Thanks for stopping.
Peace to baby.